You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm Sam Vecini. We got a great show planned for you. Dave Dufour is here. We're going to talk about five big ideas and questions that we've seen throughout the course of the NBA playoffs to this point. But before we do that, I got a quick little advertisement for you. The economy's getting back underway, and with it, the world of pro sports. Stay ahead of the curve with the unparalleled tools of two world-class news desks covering developments across finance, economics, technology, and sports. Subscribe to Bloomberg.com, and if you're not already an Athletics subscriber, for a limited time, you're going to receive a complimentary subscription to The Athletic. Go to Bloomberg.com/subscribe to sign up today. Now, let's get to that podcast with Dave Dufour. Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We're presented by The Athletic. Dave Dufour is in the building. Dave, we have a new name for the NBA G League Select Team. It is called the G League Ignite. How do you feel about these young guys going to the G League and playing for a team called the Ignite?
This is actually breaking news to me. I did not see this.
Literally broke 5 minutes before we started podcasting.
Yeah. I don't know. What is it? 1990?
Yeah.
Is it sponsored by Jolt? What was happening?
Ignite. Do these players now go immediately to the Heat? Because typically,
sure,
the Heat's logo is a fireball, and before you go to the Heat, you have to ignite something. It feels like the Miami Heat's G League team should be called the Ignite, not this G League Select team with high schoolers and stuff.
Here's what I don't. Why wouldn't they just call it the Select Team? I don't get. What are they going to have, a mascot?
Yeah, what is the mascot going to be, like a lighter?
It's going to be a set of car keys that you can't find. Right? People walking around the gym whistling, trying to get their key finder to activate. I don't know. I've been thinking about this a lot because of the Washington football team. But
right,
to a certain degree, team names just are kind of silly. You know, I think having a nickname or whatever is fine, but how about just, the Los Angeles basketball team? I don't have a problem with that because I'm, and I get it's just not how American sports is operated, but I just don't have an issue with not having a nickname. Just who cares?
So you
put
want
a jersey.
You want it to be like European soccer where
it'd be better.
Tottenham goes by the Spurs, right?
And sure.
Because it's Tottenham Hotspur. Or you want it to be like Liverpool or Manchester United. Of those teams.
Red Devils,
They have nicknames, but they don't go by the nickname.
Exactly. And I think that would be much cooler. Also would emphasize the local roots, which might make fans a little bit more apt to, show out and support and things like that. I don't know. I'm literally just thinking out loud on a train of thought that I maybe have had twice before, all because of this Ignite nickname.
What a
weird choice. It's a weird thing to think about. Is there going to be a G League season next year? Are we sure?
Oh, no, we have no idea.
But let's name the select team something. I don't know. I feel like there's bigger fish to fry.
You know what it did, Dave? It ignited our conversation today.
It did. It did. It got me fired up.
And the idea behind today's podcast is I'm going to ask Dave 5 questions about things we've seen in the NBA playoffs, and we're just going to kind of jump off of that. It's not going to be like a wildly long podcast because I've done enough of those recently. We just want to get to the meat of the matter here. We want to talk about 5 things that we've seen in the playoffs so far that will either be about what we've seen so far or how what we've seen so far can be parlayed into the future. So the first question for Dave Dufour I've got is, the Donovan Mitchell, Jamal Murray leap for real? Are these guys legitimately going to turn into what we saw from them in this first round playoff series, where I believe they combined for 475 points and it was the most points ever scored by a duo in a playoff series? Is the kind of play that we saw from them in Denver's win over Utah in 7 games sustainable over the course of the next few years? Or is this a bubble mirage that is just going to continue to look kind of silly further we go out?
I doubt these guys are going to shoot like 60% from 3 or whatever it was. I mean, you know, they were basically shooting into the ocean. I don't foresee that being in their futures going forward. Listen, both of these guys are good players. Here's the difference. With Jamal Murray, the issues are not his ceiling games, which we got to see here in the playoffs. It's the floor games. It's the games where he might score like 9 points. And if he just turns into a guy whose floor is like 16 to 18 points, we feel completely different about Jamal Murray. So I hope this is that Jamal Murray, because Jamal is very good. I mean, some of the stuff he was doing as a pick and roll ball handler in this series was just, I mean, Steph Curry.
Right.
Like, so I hope that we're just going to see him, you know, raise that floor. He's already a good player. With Donovan, I mean, he had a really good season. The stuff that I really liked out of Donovan was that he could turn it up, and not only turn it up in scoring, but also usage, right? Like, he was dominating the ball for them quite a bit. I think that's a good thing to have. It's very valuable. Obviously, he can create off the dribble. That's not an issue. That's the most valuable skill you can have as an NBA player. But on the defensive end, he also turned it up.
Yep.
And, I mean, he was – I know Jamal hit a lot of shots, but it wasn't for lack of defense. The defense was solid. It's just that these guys were both just on fire. I've never seen two guys get that hot for that long. It was insane. So I guess my answer is sort of. It's sort of real in that we saw them do things that we thought they could do, right? Is it sustainable? Definitely. It's for both guys. I think that the big thing is just making a conscious decision to do it. And Furry, he's got an ideal situation because the best player on his team would love to just give all of his shots to Jamal Murray.
Yep.
Right? Like, that's not a problem for Jokic. I've seen that guy take one shot until like 5 minutes left in the game. So Jamal probably has an easier path to that. Of course, the defensive stuff is an issue, but we're just talking about the scoring.
Let's talk about the few reasons here why you might not necessarily believe in this. I think these guys have gotten better for sure. I think they took the time off to improve their games, and you know, specifically for Jamal Murray, it's enormous for Denver that he has made this leap, because that contract at the end of the regular season in March, when play was suspended, that contract was looking a little bit questionable. Like, we can just be honest about it, right? Like, that deal looked like it had potential to end poorly because of how expensive it is. Like, even if Jamal Murray was going to be a $22 million a year player, which is an exceptionally valuable, like, even beyond mid-tier starting point guard, maybe slightly above average starting point guard in the NBA, that contract was about to be a problem. So the leap that he's made is very real. There are 3 factors here, though, that I think are worth noting. So first, everyone I've talked to in the bubble so far is just like the sight lines are unbelievable for these guys. Shooting is a real thing, right? I've mentioned this on, I think, a couple of podcasts now, so I'm not going to like delve deep into it, right? Getting to play in an arena where you don't have fans, you know, bothering you, where you don't, where you have this like shooting backdrop that looks exceptional, right? It's just going to be a little bit easier to shoot, right? And guys like Jamal Murray, Donovan Mitchell, I think that they are the beneficiaries of this, because the second point here is that they got a fuck ton of open shots.
A ton.
These two defenses, I mean, holy shit.
Donovan Mitchell was legitimately walking into wide open threes.
Yeah. Until
Gary Harris came back, I mean, I really, I can't believe the Nuggets pulled this off, and they wouldn't have without Gary Harris.
Yeah, I think that Gary Harris's inclusion from injury kind of swung the series. I tweeted that last night. I genuinely believe it, because they needed someone to be able to shadow Donovan across the court. But both of these defenses were exceptional in terms of how bad they were. I know that it was 80 to 78 last night, but that was more just like bad shot making to me. And
right.
It being like a tough
guys look
game seven
tight.
Environment. Yeah.
But also tight. Guys look kind of tight. But also, man, they'd been playing game seven basketball for a while. And I also think that the defensive effort from both teams did increase. And
it was better.
And Mike Malone put out a lot of defense-heavy lineups, which he typically doesn't do.
When you play Michael Porter, Jamal Murray, and Nikola Jokic in the same lineup,
yeah,
it's just going to be really hard. It's going to be really hard to defend with those three guys.
And don't forget, man, Paul Millsap looks like he fell off a cliff. Yeah. So, I you know, that really hurt them. I don't think that this would have been... I think this would have been over in five or six for the Nuggets if they had just been healthy. And I don't know what's going on with Paul Millsap. I'm just assuming there's a health issue of some sort, because he looks like a totally different player than he did in February.
And then the third thing that I want to bring up is everyone's kind of talking about how tired these guys are after the games because they go hard. Like we saw Jamal Murray.
Yeah.
It was a great interview with Scott Van Pelt, right? Where Scott reminded him that they have to play on Thursday again. And Jamal was like, oh, really? Game's Thursday. Having said that, the wear and tear that these guys aren't putting on their bodies by having to fly and travel and get jet lagged and everything, I think that that's playing a role in the offense being ahead of the defense in this playoffs. Guys just being able to compete in a way that is slightly more unimpeded, I think it really, really helps them hit their ceiling offensively.
I mean, look, I predicted that the defense wouldn't be any good until we got to the conference finals when we were coming back, you know, from the hiatus. I really didn't think that anyone would be defending at a high level, period.
I think you've been proven right.
Okay, I thought I lost you for a second. You kind of cut out. Sorry about that.
No, I think you've been proven right on that, to be honest. And, you know, we talked about that, I think, on our initial podcast previewing the Western Conference.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the defense was always going to be hard in this. And I think that I didn't really... I believed it, but I think I underestimated how much it was going
to
be.
It just takes so long, man, to get a defense clicking. And then knowing that guys are going to go harder on the offensive end than they do on the defensive end. And being out of shape. Like, there were just so many things there that, for me, just from experience, said the defense is going to be awful. I didn't expect guys shooting like this, though, because this is not all defense. A lot of this is that the shot making in these bubble games have just, I mean, it's just been
ridiculous.
Unlike anything ever in NBA history. I've never seen anything like this.
Oh, it's been unbelievable. It's been a great privilege to watch, almost. Like, getting to watch Jamal Murray and Donovan Mitchell, like when I bring up these factors behind part of their production, I don't mean it to diminish the shot making that they had, right? Like their performances were incredible and they deserve to be recognized as such. But I just think there are a few factors worth noting. And That's kind of where I stand on it. I mean, where mm-hmm. are you on this?
Well, again, for these guys, I don't think what we saw felt that unbelievable. It was more just unbelievable that it happened for both of them at the same time.
Yep.
And I think that the bubble is sort of the perfect condition for things like that to happen. And in particular, this series, with how the point of attack defense was so soft yep. both ways. So, look, perfect storm, yes. Repeatable? Maybe. I think that both of these guys are totally capable of putting up 50-point games here and there during the regular season. I don't think we saw anything out of them that was that crazy, except how many shots they were just throwing up and were dropping in. That's it. I mean, but that's unsustainable for anybody. One game here and there, sure. Definitely not doing it for a week.
Number two of our five questions here. Do the Raptors have enough offensive firepower to overcome the Boston Celtics and make this a series at least? Because we knew coming in that the Raptors' question was half-court offense, right? Like we mm-hmm. this was the obvious question. Can they get enough shot creation? And through two games, Jason Tatum has been by far the best shot mm-hmm. creator on the court, followed by Kemba Walker being the next best shot creator on the court. So do you believe that the Raptors can find enough offense to make this a series?
Definitely doesn't feel like it, does it? I will say Fred VanVleet not shooting well is seriously hurting them, but maybe he's just not shooting well right now. Maybe Boston is bothering him. Maybe it's not just that he's missing yep. shots. I mean, they are long and they defend the three. So it doesn't feel like it. This was the 16th ranked half court offense in the regular season. That's not going to get it done. And part of that is just they just don't have reliable guys. They don't have a guy that can get them a bucket, like you mentioned, Jason Tatum. They don't yeah. have that guy. Pascal is not that guy.
That's exactly who I was going to bring up. I feel like they thought Pascal was going to be that guy. I personally thought that Pascal had a good shot to be that guy.
Mm-hmm. I think he can sort of do it. But sort of doesn't get you to the finals. Right.
Yeah. Like
sort of doesn't get you to the finals.
He's going to be better off being a number two than he is being a number one. Because whenever he's a number one, you can sell out and put your best defender on him. And he's not being put into positions if he has the ball in hand and has to create the advantage himself to right. where he can move off the ball, use his cutting, use his off-ball ability to create these little advantages before he receives the ball to create offense. So, yeah, I thought that the Raptors had a really good shot to make the finals before mm-hmm. these first two games. And look, like they lost by three and they led for a good portion of that game yesterday. So mm-hmm. I think it would be foolhardy to write them off. But at the same time, man, it is just really, really hard for them to generate anything that looks easy, right? Like right. everything that they do looks tough. And that's partly on Boston's defense. Marcus mm-hmm. Smart has been all over the place. Jason Tatum has been an underrated help side defender the entire year. He's wreaking havoc for Boston in this series. Jaylen Brown is a good on-ball defender. Like Daniel Tice was great in game one, was unbelievable in game one, I thought. And even more than that, because Toronto plays these two guards in Kyle Lowry and Fred VanVleet, Boston can feel free to keep Kemba Walker on the court without real concern. Because mm-hmm. there's always going to be someone for him to guard. A team like Miami, a team like Milwaukee, if Milwaukee doesn't necessarily play, or if Eric Bledsoe isn't healthy or isn't in the lineup at the time, those teams can take a bit more advantage of Kemba Walker on defense. Toronto, they struggle taking advantage of him because they play so small in the backcourt.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm right there with you. I just think they're not going to be able to get it done in the half court at all. And Boston is so good at limiting transition. Good luck there. Yeah. And the Gasol and Ibaka, I mean, I don't know if they should be starting Gasol. I don't think it's a great matchup for him.
I agree. I don't know that he's mobile enough anymore. I don't know if Serge is mobile enough. Like, to me, I would be really interested to see them play more lineups that are...
With Chris Boucher?
No, I was going to say okay, play Pascal at the five.
That's interesting.
Play Lowry, Van Vliet, Powell.
Slide OG up, yeah.
Slide OG up the lineup, slide Pascal up the lineup and see what happens. Mm-hmm. Get a little bit more
match up with Tice.
Yeah, get a little bit more creation. Force Tice potentially into a slight mismatch. Get a little bit more mobile on the defensive end, to where Boston might not be able to take advantage of as many situations. You know, maybe even like look, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson gives you some even further concerns offensively, but Rondae also gives you a pretty decent matchup on Jason Tatum. That's and true. He's a good cutter that Jason always has to pay attention to, which might take some of his help side attention off of playing passing lanes and being kind of a menace getting into those. So I do think there are adjustments that Toronto can make, but what we've seen so far, I do really worry about them just having enough firepower. And I've talked a lot this season about Toronto's defense being, to me, the most versatile defense left in the playoffs, right? Miami might be proving that wrong right now. Like Miami can just match up with you in a lot of different ways and has a lot of different looks that they can throw at Milwaukee. And they're certainly doing that right now. But Toronto to me had a bunch of different lineups that they could throw at a team like a Boston, like a Milwaukee, like a Miami that I thought would be real problematic for these teams. And Boston hasn't had it easy so far. You know, really, like, they have to rely on Jason Tatum and Kemba Walker, like, really creating shots and creating tough shots and making them. But they just have more dudes that can make and create those tough shots at the end of the day. And, like, basketball comes down to dudes more than it does X's and O's.
Absolutely. I think Boston's probably going to win this in five or six.
I think that's where I'm at. Like I was really high on Toronto, and I think that's where I'm at.
Me too. Kyle Lowry being finished hurts them a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It really does. Before we get to the next question, let's take a quick commercial break.
This is the Athletic Football Show.
I think every football season's a big challenge in one way or another.
Introducing The Athletic Football Show, an all-new podcast with me, Robert Mays, and a team of world-class NFL writers and analysts. We'll feature expert guests and our plugged-in beat writers from around the league.
What Patrick Mahomes did in the last 9 minutes is just absurd.
You can subscribe now to The Athletic Football Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcast provider of your choice. And stay with us all season long as The Athletic brings you what matters most in today's NFL.
All right, we're back here with Dave Dufour. The next question is number three, and it kind of dovetails nicely off of what we were talking about just a minute ago. It's very simple. Who is the second best player in the Eastern Conference? I feel like coming in to the playoffs, you could have answered this a variety of different ways, and I think that, honestly, a lot of people would have said Joel Embiid. Mm-hmm. I think there's a pretty real case that Joel Embiid is like fourth or fifth right now. After the playoffs, where are you? Who is the second best player in the Eastern Conference?
Well, I mean, it's Jason Tatum or Jimmy Butler. Yeah. It's one of those two guys. And, you know, to be honest with you, I think Tatum has been doing outside of that Bucks game, the very first game in the bubble. He's done it every single game. The guy just, I mean, the shot making, the shot creation, the defense, he's been doing everything. And then Jimmy, he waited till the playoffs, and then he's just like, okay, I'm Jimmy Butler, which, you know, he's a veteran. He earned that, and he's been fantastic. Now, we need to see what Jason's going to do as the stakes get higher. We know what Jimmy does when the stakes are high. So I think that based on play right now, I'm probably leaning Jason Tatum, but it could change in a heartbeat. Who knows? It's that close.
Yeah, you mentioned those six games that Jason Tatum played in the seeding round. 25.6 rebounds, 4 assists, while shooting 54% from the field and 49% from three. So far in the playoffs, Jason Tatum is averaging 27 points a game, 9 rebounds, 3 assists, 49% from the field, 47% from three. And a lot of these three-point shots are like just ridiculous pull-up shots. The leap that we saw from Jason Tatum in January, I think it's very clear that that is who Jason is. Mm-hmm. And he has a very real case as a top 10 player in the NBA.
Guy might be an MVP candidate next year. I mean, this is like he's on another level right now. He really is. He needs to be in that same conversation with Luka and Anthony Davis and Giannis and LeBron and whoever else. I mean, he is. This is who this guy is. He's really good.
Yeah, I actually got some shit from people whenever I did the rookie scale rankings and ranked Jason at number three, and I put him in my top tier and said, these are the guys who can be number one options on NBA title teams.
Jason Tatum could be that this year.
Yeah, like I think Jason Tatum has a very real shot to be that guy. In fact, I kind of think he is going to be that guy at some point in his career. I think Luka is going to
be that
guy
this year. He has a legitimate chance to be that guy this year. They are 6 wins away from making it to the finals.
It's really unbelievable. Jason Tatum is awesome. The leap that he's made as a pull-up shooter is very real. The defensive end is just an enormous difference maker. Like, I am pretty sure that if you made me pick one of him or Luka Doncic, I think I would still take Luka Doncic to build around.
The defense makes that conversation much different, though.
Jason, because he's a good defender, makes this a real conversation now. He has turned into a guy that is in that conversation now. It's not just, oh yeah, Luka's the best young player in the NBA, and you know that is what it is, right? It's now Jason Tatum is in that same conversation and deserves to be in that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree.
Jimmy Butler, I think, is worth bringing up here as well. Jimmy has just been phenomenal in the playoffs. He does not want to lose. The fact that he is as competitive as he is, our own Sam Amick wrote a really great interview with Jimmy today over at The Athletic, stating just kind of everything that Jimmy is about from an ethos standpoint. It was just a remarkable interview seeing how much candor Amick got from Jimmy. I mean, there are, I will say, like, if I was building a roster, I would want guys like Jimmy Butler. I get that he is very polarizing, but if I'm building a team, that's the kind of guy that I want on my team.
Mm-hmm. I agree. He's great. He basically stopped shooting jump shots during the regular season to the point where it was like fewer than 24% of his shots happened out of the paint. And now all of a sudden he's just like, okay, well, I'm just going to walk into these threes. He might have made 5 threes after Christmas. It's crazy.
Now he's just knocking them down.
Guy's a gamer.
Like, it's nothing.
Guy's a gamer. Yeah. Yeah. Guy's a gamer.
And then the last guy that was kind of in this conversation to start the playoffs was Joel Embiid. I mean, do you have any strong opinions on the way that you build around someone like Joel Embiid? Like, do we think that he is diminished in any way that these playoffs went? Because, like, I do have some questions about him being your. I have some questions about him being the best player on a title team just because of the way that the modern NBA is. But in terms of how good he is as a person, like, I'm not as concerned, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not concerned. Why can't you just treat him like Olajuwon? Put 4 shooters around him and prosper. I just, it's not that hard. I mean, certainly finding 4 shooters is difficult, especially if you're Philadelphia. But just build a team around him. He is a dominant force. He's amazing as a post-up guy, which, you know, is unheard of in the modern NBA. It's basically him and Jokic that are the only bigs that do that. He raises your floor on defense and by the way, gives you a pretty high ceiling too because he's so talented there. It just isn't that difficult. Spread the floor, let him eat. Now, he's like the only big I would say that about, but do it.
I think I agree with you that he's the only big guy I would say that about. I still have some concerns because of the way that it limits the way that you can build your roster. I think that you want to be able to build a roster with as many options as possible, right? And you want to have as many opportunities available to you as possible because you never know what's actually going to come up. And if you feel like you can't take advantage of one of those opportunities because you have a guy in Joel Embiid that you have to kind of build around, it takes some opportunities off the table, right? That'd be my only concern, is that like Philadelphia might not have a full range of possibilities that they can explore as they build this roster. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But that's Philadelphia.
Right. Like maybe there's another team out there for Joel.
Maybe.
At some point.
Maybe.
All right. Question four. What is Mike Budenholzer doing?
What is Mike Budenholzer? That's the first question, right? I don't know, man. Like,
can I just like kind of give the two things that are bothering me?
So, yes. Yeah.
One of them is Giannis Antetokounmpo playing 35 minutes a night. Like, you can't do that in the playoffs whenever you're playing a team like Miami who will try and
rip
your
heart out. If he didn't play the final 16 minutes, he would have not gotten to 36 minutes.
Like, what? How is this happening still? Like, I had someone mention to me in like my Twitter mentions, like, oh, maybe because he plays so hard, you need him to be fresh, and like they think that their only chance of going further in the playoffs is if he's fresh because he plays 35 minutes. Man, Giannis is a fucking alien. Like, I don't think that guy gets tired.
I've never heard anything to suggest he's not a 40 plus minute a game guy if it needed to be. Now, if he's Joel Embiid and he can't play that much, okay, but that's new information.
Right.
He's never been treated that way. Nope. You've never heard, like, we're watching his minutes load outside of, you know, getting ready for the playoffs.
We've never heard questions about his
poor
work
management.
Ethic.
Also, play him the first 24 minutes, not the last 24. Like, get the game over early.
Right.
He fouled him out in the second quarter. He had three fouls, and, you know, that was it. Sporadic at the beginning of the third. I mean, you only get 48 minutes. You need your best players on the court for as many of those as you can get, especially against a good team. And Miami, you know, the frustrating part, if you're watching the Bucks, is that Miami has been doing this all year. You know exactly what their game plan is, and you know that it was designed to destroy your drop coverage.
Yep.
And yet, what happened? Now, listen, no Eric Bledsoe is a big deal because Eric Bledsoe is extremely important. But what that does is that bumps everyone up a notch. So you wind up with a lot of Kyle Korver, a lot of Pat Connaughton, and probably even too much Dante DiVincenzo. That's an issue. That's a legitimate concern. Miami is a good team. These games shouldn't be blowouts. Not that this was, but these should be close games. But you lose one of your best guys, and certainly it's going to have an effect. But your strategy just was ineffective from the jump. They backcut them to death. They scored so much at the basket. It was like watching a different team.
Yeah, and this is a Milwaukee team. Their whole basis is defending at the basket.
That's
period.
Right.
Like, that's all they want to do, and you are 100% right. They backcut them to death. They cleared out Jimmy against Chris Middleton, and Chris is a good defender. Don't get me wrong. Like,
Jimmy hit tough shots.
Yeah. Chris forced him into tough shots, but you know what? Like, Jimmy was getting into the paint when he wanted to, too. Like, he was making tough floaters over Chris Middleton and over Brook Lopez even a couple of times. But at the same time, like, if something's not working, you got to do something different. And I'm not even saying put Giannis on him, because Giannis, I saw Nate Jones tweet about this last night or two nights ago or whatever, but I thought it was really astute, because Giannis is closer to like the Anthony Davis style defender than he is like a lockdown, shutdown, one-on-one, on-ball defender, right? Like, that's where he derives his value. He derives his value
right.
with the threat of him coming over from the weak side and using his length and using his strength and just being a constant presence there. If you take him away from that, I actually think the drop coverage scheme becomes even more ineffectual. Like, they actually need Giannis to be on the weak side whenever Miami, Brook Lopez has to come out.
Yeah, Miami would love it if Giannis was trying to guard Jimmy Butler one-on-one. Great. Now we have all kinds of stuff to get to the basket, like all this space to get to the basket. Come on. It's just insane, man. And the people who say stuff like that just expose themselves as being ignorant of how NBA defense works. And I mean the players that said it too. They clearly just, and by the way, only a couple players that I saw say it, and none of them are good defenders. So I guess, you know, that kind of speaks for itself.
I think that there's like a reasonable case to be made if Milwaukee wants to make an adjustment to play like Giannis at the five and go smaller and, you know, all of that stuff. Like, if you want to try and do that, there might be a case to be made where you're no longer playing your drop coverage scheme. Maybe you're switching all actions because that feels like it's slightly easier to implement on the fly whenever you're totally changing what you do, right? Maybe then that could be a circumstance where you guard Jimmy Butler with Giannis. But it would involve completely changing what you do defensively. And that's what no team wants to do, especially the best team in the league wants to do in the second round of the NBA playoffs. I get that there's an argument to be made about adjusting on the fly and having to make adjustments to win. And that's part of, you know, what the question mark is about Mike Budenholzer, right? Like, he almost seemingly never adjusts to what other teams present him. But there's got to be a middle ground between totally changing what you do and adjusting slightly within the margins of what you do to what Miami is doing.
There's also a little bit of, you know, this is carryover from last year, right? Milwaukee doesn't have the athletes.
Right.
So they're trying to out-talent you, and they just don't have the athletes to help with that part of it. Miami's got athletes.
I have some real concerns about the fact that Milwaukee is, you know, made 46% from three in that first game.
Oh, yeah. And they still lost.
Lost by that 10.
That never happens, by the way. That right. never. When the trick for beating the Bucks is for you to hit your threes and for them to miss. And they outshot the Heat and still lost. That is extremely rare. But this is because Miami was getting so much at the basket.
What do you think the adjustment is for Milwaukee defensively? Because
switch it, start switching.
You think they're just going to have, I mean, that is like somewhat of an abandonment of what they do though. You think they're just going to straight up have to start switching things?
I don't think they got to switch on the ball. I think that they could still do a modified drop where you're switching stuff away from the ball. The back cuts, the stuff that was opening up, you know, layups, just get rid of that. Like, you've just got to cut that stuff out. And, you know, they're very good at the scram switch too. So like if they do switch, I trust Giannis or Brooke or whoever's back there to find the proper matchup. I just think that just letting these guys get to the basket is not great. And I mean, there were times where Pat Connaughton screened his own teammate and gave up a layup. You've got to do better than what you're doing right now. And what they're doing right now is just, you know, it's a layup line. So I think switch that stuff away from the ball. Just make it a little easier on your guys. And then Giannis has got to stay out of foul trouble because clearly Bud is not going to play him if he picks up three fouls. So, and that's tough because he fouls a lot.
He does. He plays so physical. He plays with offensive fouls, power. Man. He's going to
guys slide in front of him.
Yep. The fifth question here. Yeah, Mike Budenholzer. Like, my solution is like, Mike, fucking play Giannis. Like, seriously.
Well, yeah, that's number
play
one.
Giannis 42 minutes a night. Like, this is not
Play him 48. I don't care, but play him.
Play him. Go down with your best guy fighting and scrapping and clawing.
Yeah.
Question five. The Los Angeles Clippers and Lakers get an enormous big rest advantage against their opponents now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this matters? And are these two teams still on a collision course to play in the Western Conference Finals?
So it's a tricky question because there is something to be said for guys like getting their legs under them and being on a roll, like you assume the Nuggets are right now. But look at what happens when you've got that playoff intensity for sustained periods. So the Blazers in round one, by the time they had played the Lakers in game one, which they won, they had already played 8 game sevens. Think about it. Like, they knew, like, they had to win every game. Every game was a must win. And they played like it. And then they won game one. I'm not surprised by that. That they were more ready than the Lakers were. And it was, you know, the Lakers also had a historic poor shooting night. The worst shooting night since tracking data started being tracked, as far as expected field goal percentage versus actual. And then the Lakers, hey, we're a better team, and they just played better. But I think that part of that was that the Blazers were so exhausted. I mean, they looked dead on the court. There were times where I thought Nurkic wasn't going to make it back on defense. Like, he just looked so tired. So I think the rest advantage in particular is heightened in this environment. And especially because both of these teams are coming off game sevens. It's a big deal. And it helps that the Clippers and Lakers are both better than the opponents that they're going to face.
Right. And they don't have to travel again. Like, this is mm-hmm. a situation where these teams that are resting, they're getting like genuine rest without having to fly somewhere. They are
right.
sitting. They might be fishing. They might be just on a, you know, I guess like a pseudo beach, given the fact that Orlando is inland, but like they might be by a pool hanging out. Like, they are getting actual rest time to get better. And I would think that that is going to play a big role. The Clippers have had some injuries as well. Like, I would think that, you know, maybe getting a chance to get Patrick Beverley healthy to be able to have him run around on Jamal Murray like crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, that'll be valuable. I think these two teams are on a collision course. I think the rest will help them. I don't really see a world where the Clippers lose this series, just because I feel like they have enough guys to throw at Jokic and throw at Jamal Murray that can slow them down. I mean, like, if it's Houston, you can maybe make like a variance case where they just knock down a ton of shots against the Lakers and Frank Vogel, for some strange reason, like, refuses to go small and play AD at the five. Like, is there a world where you can see either of these teams losing?
Well, I think Jokic is a slightly smaller but better version of Boban. And I watched the Clippers struggle with Boban. You know, I think Jokic and Zubac, that's a mismatch. And Jokic can exploit that in a way that Dallas couldn't in the first round. And it's not like you can really put Trez on him because...
Oh, no. Yeah.
You know, he just can't do anything there. So
too small, he'll pass over him mm-hmm. pretty easily.
Yeah, yeah. So I do think if Jokic is able to get going and get everyone else going, that's when Jokic is really going. It's not when he puts up 30. So when he puts up like 24, but has like 14 assists, that's a Jokic's cooking game. And if he can get some games like that, then certainly they could pull this off. I don't think they're going to be able to defend well enough to do it. But if he can do that, he gives them a puncher's chance to be in it from an offensive perspective. The defense is going to be rough, though. I mean, Torrey Craig, Gary Harris, Jerian Grant, expect to see a lot of that. Those three are going to be out there a ton.
And like part of why the Clippers, I think, are just so ridiculous and so good is that I almost don't know that it matters who you have on the court defensively. Like, they're just going to make tough shots. Like, Lou Williams is a tough shot maker. Kawhi Leonard is a tough shot maker. Paul George is a tough shot maker. Like, I almost feel like Denver might be better off going all offense and just, like, trying to keep up because, like, Kawhi, Paul George, these guys are just going to make shots at the end of the day. Like, that's kind of just where I'm at on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, they are definitely going to hit shots. I mean, this series could be a sweep. It really could. Like, the Clippers could sweep them. I think the Lakers are probably going to win their series in 4 or 5 games, too. These have been far and away the best two teams in the West. I'm not going to do to them something that I would, you know, wouldn't do to the Bucks. I have to go on the whole body of work, and I don't expect either one of these teams to really struggle with the next playoff series.
Yeah, Houston. The problem is that Russ doesn't look totally right yet.
He's hurting them.
Yeah. I don't know if it's rhythm. Like, I'm not sure what it is. He doesn't look great. Maybe he can use tonight to get into rhythm. If it's Oklahoma City, I just frankly don't know if that team's talented enough.
Well, Steven Adams looks washed, so I'm not sure.
Yeah,
you know, not sure if he can do enough, and he needs to play, but I'm not sure if he can do enough to keep them in it.
Yeah, like, they can't really play Noel because he just isn't very good.
Right.
And then Bazley is too small to deal with Anthony Davis. Yeah. Adams is going to have to play in Adams. It was funny. Like, Adams looked great at the start of the bubble. And, like, I thought that his athleticism, like, looked a little bit poppier and looked a little bit more rested, I guess. Cause typically Adams does break down by the end of the year, but he's not there, unfortunately, right now.
Yeah.
Dave, do you have any other, do you have any strong takes you got to get off your chest before we go?
No, not really. You know, I'm never going to overreact from one game. I think the Bucks still will probably wind up winning this series. I hope. I don't really care, but, you know, I hope, because then I don't have to throw out regular season completely.
Well, if you're going to do it any year, this year.
This might be the year that I have to do it. But I mean, going forward. I think the Bucks are going to be fine and be in the series. No problem. Boston looks much better than I anticipated. They're a lot of fun. But no real strong takes, to be honest with you. A lot of it is just like, okay, this is a lot of what we know. And then there are some really interesting things that we didn't know. Like, Donovan Mitchell being able to defend like he did, even though, you know, he got lit up. It was, you know, the process was good.
Yeah, I thought he actually defended well, especially later in that series. I think both teams got better and more engaged later in that series. But
yeah, but both of those guys were just hitting shots. I mean, you know, and at the end of the day, you have to tip your cap. But I thought what he was doing physically on the defensive end was good.
Yeah. Dave, tell the people what you've got coming up. Tell them all the random podcasts you're on.
Everything
in the world.
Well, everyone knows, you know, all everything's at The Athletic. So you can follow me there on that app, and I think you get alerts when I put out something new. We'll have a new Nerder coming out Friday. Should be good. We're going to talk a lot about Mo Dakeel's great article on Bleacher Report that he just wrote about the art of cutting, which is timely because Miami is one of the best cutting teams I've ever watched. So look for that. Go read that article, by the way. Mo's doing great stuff. And then, you know, we'll probably dig in a little bit on Utah and some of the decisions they have to make, because they're in a really interesting place from a team building perspective. So definitely talk about some of that stuff.
Yeah. And the Miami cutting thing is interesting too, because they have to pay. They utilize so many of those cutting actions coming off of Duncan Robinson too. Mm-hmm. And teams have to pay so much attention to Duncan coming
off.
Well,
and that's where missing Bledsoe is rough.
Is enormous. It's so, so big. But that was Dave Dufour. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, do anything you can to support the podcast. We'll be back next week at some point with some more discussion of the NBA, the NBA draft, whatever else we want to talk about. I've also got a really interesting special guest that's been on the show before, but it's been a couple of years. So until next time, though, we'll talk soon. Bye.
Hold on.